On September 11th, 2000, at approximately 4:47 a.m., 8-year-old Zachary Bernhardt was reported missing from his apartment in Clearwater, Florida. Within hours, hundreds of investigators and volunteers were searching for him, but they found no trace of Zach, and as the investigation unfolded, they began questioning whether they had been told the full story about what happened that night. More than 25 years later, Zach remains missing, and everyone is left asking the same question: what happened to Zach Bernhardt? Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to this case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. All right, so Zachary's case is one of the difficult ones, not only because it involves a child, but whenever I cover a case like this, or even on Crime Weekly, where there's parental supervision questions, right, you know, that we're going to ask, it's difficult. Some people can be very sensitive about it, and I totally understand that. And when you consider the fact that the parents are potentially just as much of a victim as the children themselves, it is something that you have to be cognizant of. And we have a responsibility as storytellers to make sure that we don't disrespect the family or the people who are personally connected to this case. However, I also think I have a responsibility to be impartial and truthful and objective, and to not hide behind certain things because I'm afraid to offend someone. As an investigator, we do have to ask difficult questions because that's the only way we're ever going to get to the truth. If we're concerned with pissing people off or upsetting someone, there's an opportunity to miss something, to have a blind spot that may actually lead you to what you're looking for. So I do think it comes with experience and you have to be sensitive to the situation, but you also have to keep in mind why you're here. It's to get answers. It's to find resolution. And it's to figure out what happened to the people that are the topic of the conversation. And that's what we're going to do. I'm going to continue to do that. I've been doing it my whole life. I've been involved in investigations now for almost 22 years. And I've definitely pissed some people off. But at the core, my heart is always in the right place. And tonight is no different. We're going to talk about a young boy who disappeared and has never been found. And there are going to be some questions about his mother's decisions. And whenever we have a case like this, I like to compare it to a fork in the road. Not only with a case this significant, but also just any bad decision that we make or any set of circumstances that occur that maybe we didn't want to happen. And in most instances, there's a fork in the road where you have an opportunity to go one way or the other. Now, you may have had that same fork in the road 100 times, and luckily nothing bad happened. But all it takes is one time. One time where you choose the wrong path or you make a decision that probably wasn't best for everybody involved, and it could be a life-altering decision. And I do feel like that's what happened here, but I'm going to give you all the information. I'm going to give you my opinions on it, and I'm looking forward to hearing yours. So we have a lot to get into. Let's dive into this week's case. Zachary Michael Cole Bernhardt was born on December 18, 1991. His mother, Leah Hackett, was only 20 years old when she had him. Zach's father was not involved in his life, so Leah gave him her mother's married last name, and that was Bernhardt. Throughout Zach's childhood, he and Leah moved frequently, bouncing from house to house, usually living with Leah's boyfriends. In 1994, Leah had a daughter, and after she was born, the daughter's father sued for custody. So Leah moved to Florida with both children, which the judge allowed. And life remained pretty unstable. Leah struggled to keep a job and developed a habit of dropping her children off with other people, then disappearing for days at a time so she could go party. And during those absences, she often had no contact with anyone and was reported missing on multiple occasions. After disappearing on one of those times, Leah agreed to let her daughter go live with her father. So that left just Leah and Zach. And the instability continued. Leah would get an apartment, then she would get evicted, so she would go stay with friends, and then eventually be asked to leave. And because they moved so often, Zach attended multiple schools. By the beginning of September 2000, Leah and Zach had been living at the Savannah Trace apartment complex, Unit 634, located at 2690 Drew Street in Clearwater, Florida, for approximately a year. Now, I'm going to pull up a photo of the Savannah Trace apartment complex here. And just so you guys know, it has gone through a couple transitions. At one point, it was the Standard. And from what I'm seeing online now, it's the Eden at Clearwater. But what you need to take away from this is that this apartment complex is massive. It's huge. And there's like an overall shot that you're going to see here if you're watching on YouTube, and you'll see how just big it is and how many parking spots and apartments are in there and vehicles. So there's a lot of people living at this location. Okay, so back to September of 2000. At that time, Zach was 8 years old and he was in the third grade. He was inquisitive. He liked taking things apart and doing crafts. He also loved the beach and water. Swimming and building sandcastles were two of his favorite things to do. At that time, Leah was 29 years old and working as a night shift telemarketer. She was still struggling financially, and on September 6th, she received an eviction notice for failing to pay rent. 4 days later, on September 10th, Leah did not have to work, and neighbors at the apartment complex saw Zach outside playing during the day, but they did not see Leah. That evening, Zach went back to the apartment to spend the evening with Leah. No one outside the apartment would ever see him alive again. Then, at 4:47 a.m. on September 11th, Leah called 911 to report Zach missing. She told investigators that she had gone for a walk, leaving Zach asleep in her bed. When she got back, he was gone. She said that she did not believe that he had run away because he was afraid of the dark, but she was very concerned that he had been abducted. Investigators responded to the apartment and immediately began searching the area while also processing the scene. There were no broken doors, no signs of forced entry, and nothing indicating a struggle. There was no blood or other obvious evidence, and none of Zach's clothing or belongings were missing from the apartment. Now, investigators did process the apartment as a crime scene, but nothing stood out. It was as if Zach had simply vanished. The search outside the apartment also turned up nothing, so an Amber Alert was issued, and the FBI, along with other local agencies, joined the search. They searched extensively using multiple methods, but there was still no sign of Zach anywhere. There wasn't even a scent trail leading away from his apartment. At the same time, approximately 50 investigators with the Clearwater Police Department worked around the clock following leads. They investigated hundreds of tips, many involving reported sightings, but once again, nothing led them to Zach. While the search continued, Leah was brought in to provide a statement. She was asked to walk investigators through what happened on September 10th and into the early morning hours of September 11th. According to Leah, after Zach came home from playing outside, she cooked one of his favorite meals and they watched a movie together. At approximately 11 p.m., Zach was ready for bed. He asked if he could sleep in Leah's bed, and she agreed. He then went to sleep wearing a t-shirt and shorts. Leah said that she was used to working nights, so she wasn't tired. Instead, she stayed up watching television, and at approximately 1 a.m., she took the trash out. She said she drove it to the apartment complex dumpster and then returned home. However, sometime between approximately 3 a.m. and 4 a.m., Leah decided to go for a walk and stop by the apartment complex pool even though it was closed. Now, it is worth noting that she stated before leaving the apartment, she did check in on Zach and he was still sleeping in her bed. Leah then left the apartment, leaving the door unlocked and the keys inside. Now, here's where it gets weird, because she says she walked to the pool and then jumped in fully clothed despite not having a swimsuit or a towel. And she told investigators that she had never done this before. In fact, she didn't even like to swim. But for some reason that night, she swam to the other side of the pool, got out, and walked back to the apartment. When she got home, Leah took a warm shower, and then she said she finished showering at approximately 4:30 a.m. When she got out, she noticed that Zach was no longer in her bed. She immediately became concerned, so Leah got dressed and searched the apartment, and when she could not find Zach, she believed he must have gone to the babysitter's apartment, so Leah rushed over there, banging on the door. The babysitter did wake up, and when she answered, she told Leah that she had not seen Zach, so Leah called the police. After hearing Leah's account, investigators asked about Zach's father. Leah told them that Zach did not know his father, and that the father did not even know Zach existed. Leah did not want to give them information about Zach's father, but eventually she relented. By the end of the interview, investigators were suspicious of Leah. Her story did not make a lot of sense, but before jumping to conclusions, they needed to investigate what she told them, and we're going to get into that right after the break. You've heard me talk about Hungry Root before, so you know how much I love it because it truly simplifies my life. As a busy parent and someone who works a lot of hours, it's been such a game changer when it comes to reaching my health goals by doing all the weekly food shopping with Hungry Root. And as I've said before, it's tailored to my needs and wants and my goals. Those goals have recently changed up. I have a project coming up soon. In fact, I think I can actually say it at this point. Big brother, I'm going to be doing the after show again, Unlocked. And I wanted to get in better shape. So I'm in there working out, cut down on the calories a little bit. I was able to do that with Hungry Root, so I was able to get food that I enjoyed, but in the calorie grouping that I was looking for. Hungry Root plans all of my meals and groceries for the week, it fills my car, and it delivers everything I'll need to eat healthy every day, all while fitting those health goals, dietary preferences, and most importantly, my budget. I have a few different favorites with Hungry Root, but the top one for me has to be the zesty pulled chicken stuffed peppers, because again, that is something that's definitely hitting the macros that I'm looking for. There's not a lot of carbs with it. And I was able to make it in under 15 minutes, which is also extremely important to me. And that's the case with most of Hungry Root's recipes. You can make them in under 15 minutes. So for a busy family, this is really going to fit what you're looking for. And so having healthy food like that delivered right to my doorstep is exactly what I need to stay on track. And unlike other food delivery companies, Hungry Root now has over 50,000 chef-crafted recipes to choose from every week. And as I mentioned earlier, they're ready in just 15 minutes or less. And with over 1,000 grocery items like smoothies, sweets, kid snacks, salad kits, ready-to-eat meals, and supplements, it's insanely easy to find options that fit everyone's taste and nutritional goals. Hungry Root holds all of its food to high standards, screening out over 200 additives, including high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and preservatives. They source only high-quality meat and seafood with no hormones or antibiotics, or for organic produce and non-GMO options, and carry trusted healthy brands like Oatly, Vital Farms, Ithaca Hummus, Harmless Harvest, and many more. You're going to love Hungry Root as much as I do, and for a limited time, you get 40% off your first box, plus get a free item in every box for life. All you have to do is go to hungryroot.com/detective and use my code detective. That's hungryroot.com/detective, code detective, to get 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life. Okay, we're back, and before the break, I talked about how investigators were insistent on learning about Zach's father, even though Leah was reluctant, and eventually she did give them that information, and the reason for that was because they knew that parental abductions were common, so they wanted to speak to Zach's father, and that's completely understandable. They should be doing that. But with several things going on, they decided to let Leah go that day, and she returned back to the apartment, but she did not speak with the media, which I have zero issues with. And investigators did track down Zach's father, by the way, and he confirmed that he had never known about Zach, and he also made it very clear that he did not want to know about Zach. So check in the box that Zach's father's a scumbag. However, based on everything they knew so far, investigators did not believe that he was involved. And so as day two began, the search for Zach remained intense. Investigators and searchers worked around the clock, continuing to do everything they could to find him. At the same time, Leah spent most of the day speaking with investigators again. They had a lot of questions about her statement. Leah maintained that she had no idea what happened to Zach. However, the lead investigator later told Investigation Discovery that the interview was, quote, really unusual. There were moments where Leah appeared to be upset, and there were other times where she made odd comments or jokes. However, the investigator also pointed out that this type of behavior can sometimes be the result of trauma. And I was going to say the same thing here, that you do have people who react to tough situations differently when they're under stress, when they're experiencing anxiety. And that's why it's important as an interrogator to develop a baseline on that specific person, because no two people are alike. And certain mannerisms for me may be different than mannerisms for you. So we could both be sitting there reacting to the same thing, and yet the way we react to it could be completely different. And so that's important here. Just because Leah may have made light of the situation at certain moments, it doesn't mean that she was hiding something or she was trying to deviate from what was actually important. On the other hand, when you actually consider the context of what she was saying, to me, that's more concerning, because her behavior that night just doesn't make sense. And to jump in a pool fully clothed, why would you do that? Especially when you don't like swimming. So yeah, you're going to have follow-up questions about that. Were you under the influence? Were you experiencing something at that time? Were you stressed out and feeling not yourself and you just had to get away? How many times before have you left the apartment at 3-4 in the morning to just go for a walk while your child was inside? And on those occasions, did you always leave the door unlocked when you're in this huge apartment complex? These are reasonable questions to ask, because on the surface, yeah, it is unusual. And so after that interview, Leah was released and returned to her apartment, and she and her family stood outside handing out flyers, but Leah continued refusing to speak with the media. Meanwhile, investigators kept digging. They spoke with family members, friends, and neighbors trying to learn more about Leah. That was when they began hearing about her past, including the evictions, numerous boyfriends, partying, and the time she had gone missing without explanation. Based on the questions investigators were asking other people, it became clear that they believed Leah could be involved in Zach's disappearance, and that deeply upset her family. At the time, and over the years since, they have consistently maintained that Leah was a single mother doing her best. They acknowledged that she had bumps in the road, like anyone else, but said that, quote, when it came to her being responsible for her child and her child's whereabouts, she was top-notch. But that was not the way the media portrayed her, and the pressure on Leah continued to build. So on September 13th, 2 days after Zach disappeared, she spoke publicly for the first time. Standing outside her apartment, she addressed the media. The Tampa Bay Times reported that Leah spoke emphatically for 1 minute as she thanked everyone who had been searching and praying for her son. She said, quote, "We miss him. We love him very much. We want him to come home." She asked people to keep searching for Zach, then, in tears, turned away and walked back up the stairs to her apartment, not answering any questions. And listen, this is where we have to have some difficult conversations, right? Because looking into this case and looking up some of the things that were online, the media and the public was not kind to Leah. There's no doubt about it. And to be fair, based on everything that I've learned and everything that I've read, I can't completely disagree with them. She didn't show a lot of care for her children. And there's no doubt that she would pawn them off so she could go out and party. Yeah, listen, we all need time apart. We all need some opportunities to decompress and do what we love. I've done it. You've probably done it. We've all done it. But I mean, this woman would go missing for days, just drop the kids off and not leave a phone number and say, yep, I'll see you when I see you. And even the whole circumstance with her daughter, right? Just basically saying, yep, you can have her. I'm good. It's too much of a inconvenience. Optically, it doesn't look great. Now, on the other hand, some of you may say, you know, this is a struggling mother who financially just couldn't get ahead and she couldn't take care of the two children. And that's okay. Listen, I was one of four. My mom is my best friend. And for a while, it was just us and her, right? And we really struggled financially. But I remember my childhood very well. And my mom was always present. She never left us alone. She would never drop us off with random people and disappear for days. So yeah, she may have had to work 3 or 4 jobs sometimes, but we were always with family members like my grandparents or my aunts or uncles. And after she got off work, she came right home and spent the time with us. And that's what I remember. So financially struggling doesn't give you an excuse to just disappear. And maybe that's just because of my own personal childhood that I feel this way. But I'm open to hearing your thoughts on it as well. And so here we are, back to this case, talking about a mother who definitely made some poor decisions. And because of that fork in the road, may have created an opportunity where not only did she leave him alone, but she left the door unlocked. That created a window where something bad could happen. And to sit here and not acknowledge that would be unprofessional and not being completely honest with you guys. And I'm not going to do that. So as the days passed, the physical search for Zach began to slow down. Investigators shifted more of their focus to traditional investigative work, including interviews and following up on tips. As they did, they continued hearing concerning information about Leah and her account of what happened that night. Some of this information came from neighbors who said that they saw Leah's car coming and going from the apartment complex during the early morning hours of September 11th, between approximately 3 a.m. and 3:45 a.m. That directly contradicted Leah's statements, which were that she was at home during that time or walking to the pool. She never mentioned getting back into her car after taking the trash out at 1 a.m. And so investigators decided to look into the neighbors' reports. However, this was before surveillance cameras were common, so there was no way to verify what the witnesses had reported. Still, it's worth noting that two separate neighbors independently reported seeing Leah's car moving during that time frame. And as you might imagine, this is a problem. I've reported to you guys multiple times that it's not uncommon to have witnesses report something that didn't happen, even though in their minds, they believe with all of their heart that that's what they saw. But when you have multiple witnesses who don't have a connection to one another, that lead starts to grow legs and starts to become more credible. And when you consider the fact that what Leah said she did that night around that time period, it does make you wonder, is she hiding something? Is there more to the story that we're unaware of? And is that piece of information that we're not being told the key to cracking this case? By September 28th, investigators had grown frustrated with Leah, and for the first time, a police spokesperson publicly acknowledged that they did not believe they had the full story, otherwise saying they didn't believe Leah was telling them everything. The spokesperson told the media, quote, "From the beginning, the officers had any number of concerns about the circumstances of his disappearance. Investigators don't believe they had the whole story from Zach's mother." At the same time, the spokesperson made it clear that Leah had not been labeled a suspect and the investigators had no evidence a crime had been committed. They also said they had uncovered no evidence that Zach was the victim of an accident or that he had run away. 2 days later, on September 30th, Leah moved out of the Savannah Trace apartment complex after being evicted. Investigators later brought her back to the apartment and asked her to walk them through that night one more time. And it's worth noting that her account remained the same. It's also worth noting that the investigators' opinion of that account did as well. Sometime after moving out, Leah stopped speaking with investigators altogether. With the person at the center of the investigation no longer cooperating, the case made very little progress. Then in the spring of 2001, investigators received information about a man named Kevin Jalbert. They learned that Jalbert had been bragging that he had abducted and raped more than 1,000 children during his lifetime and claimed he had even killed 5 of them. Clearwater police sent in an undercover detective to befriend Jalbert, and once the two developed a relationship, Jalbert invited the undercover detective on a drive around Clearwater to look for children they could abduct and kill. During that drive, Jalbert bragged about kidnapping, raping, and murdering in the past. And at one point during that ride, Jalbert drove through the Savannah Trace apartment complex where Zach had lived. He pointed to an apartment and claimed that was where he had taken his most recent victim, an 8-year-old boy. That was obviously suspicious, but there were also several problems with Jalbert's statement. He did not point to Zach's apartment. He also incorrectly described what Zach had been wearing that night and what the inside of the apartment looked like. Now, just to be devil's advocate here, I could counter that by saying maybe Zach changed before going outside, realizing that when he woke up, his mother was gone. So he changes up and then he leaves the apartment voluntarily to go look for his mom. So there's a possibility that when Zach came outside, he was wearing something completely different. And if Jalbert was involved, he could have seen Zach and then abducted him at that point, never going inside the apartment. So just something to put out there, because those two things being incorrect doesn't necessarily mean that they got the wrong guy. Even when you talk about Zach's apartment, if Zach was walking out of the complex and not necessarily near his apartment, It's very possible that Jalbert never saw where he came out of. And so after this encounter between Jalbert and the undercover detective, investigators searched Jalbert's home and his vehicle. They found a large amount of child sex abuse material, but nothing linking him to Zach's disappearance. However, investigators did have enough evidence to charge Jalbert with other crimes, including solicitation of murder and kidnapping, for asking the undercover investigator to help him find children, kidnap them, and kill them. In addition to those charges, he was also hit with 60 counts of possession of child sex abuse material. And so even though there was no physical evidence connecting Jalbert to Zach, you might be wondering, did they sit down and talk to him? Of course they did. The detective sat him down. They asked him specifically about Zach's disappearance. And for those of you who have been with me a little while, I'm sure none of you will be surprised to learn that he denied not only abducting Zach, but anyone else for that matter. And he claimed that everything he had described to the undercover detective, pure fantasy. See, he's a good guy. He's just misunderstood, right? Aren't they all? Now, I don't know if Jalbert had abducted or killed any children, but just the mere fact that he was speaking about it publicly and actually going out there with someone who he believed was a confidant and talking like this, yeah, we don't need him on the streets anymore. You can keep him behind bars. And so at that point, with Jalbert denying everything, they continued to look into him and the possibility that he was a suspect in Zach's case, but they were never able to confidently connect him to Zach's disappearance, though he has also never been ruled out. But what's important here, and I think you're all going to be happy to hear this, Jalbert was later convicted of solicitation of kidnapping, sexual assault, and murder, along with the 60 counts of possession of child sex abuse material, and he was sentenced to more than 40 years in prison. Personally, I don't think that's long enough, but 40 years for a guy like this in a prison, probably not going to end well for him. Prisoners, not all of them good people, but there is a code, and they don't take kindly to people who do bad things to children. So good luck with that one, buddy. By the beginning of September 2001, investigators were approaching the one-year mark of Zach's disappearance. Leah's family planned to speak with the media and bring renewed attention to his case. But on September 11th, 2001, as all of you know, terrorists attacked the World Trade Center in New York. The attacks immediately became the focus of news coverage around the world, and as a result, there was no media coverage marking 1 year since Zach disappeared. As you can imagine, this was devastating to Zach's family and to his case. Getting media attention in unsolved cases is so important, and it's exactly why we do what we do here on Detective Perspective. And there were no other major developments until New Year's Eve 2001, when another young boy was abducted from the same apartment complex where Zach disappeared. We're going to talk about it right after the break. Ever wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable? The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep, and that's why I switched to Miracle Made Sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology and use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help me sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. So if you're a hot sleeper, a cold sleeper, it doesn't matter. These sheets will keep you in that comfort zone so you get a great night's sleep. And thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle Made Sheets stay cleaner and fresher up to 3 times longer than regular sheets. That means fewer odors, fewer wash cycles, and way less laundry. I'm all about that. And the most important part, they feel just as good, if not better, than the sheets you'd find in some 5-star hotels, but without the steep price tag. So they're smooth, they're breathable, and they're ridiculously comfortable. They're also great for your skin. All that hidden bacteria that you find in some regular sheets, obviously not good. It can clog your pores, can cause breakouts, but Miracle Made's antibacterial design helps you sleep cleaner and clearer night after night. So upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/detective to try Miracle Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use my promo code DETECTIVE, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with their 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/detective, code DETECTIVE at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. All right, we're back, so let's talk about this other abduction. That day, 3 young boys were playing on the apartment complex playground when a truck pulled up. A man got out and offered the boys ice cream, and one of them, a 5-year-old boy, walked over. The man grabbed him, forced him into the truck, and drove away. Approximately 10 hours later, nearly 80 miles away, someone heard cries coming from a dumpster. They went to investigate, and they found the boy inside. He had been injured, but he was alive. Because of the child's age, investigators never publicly released his identity or many details about what happened during the abduction. They did say that the boy described his abductor as a white man with dark, stringy hair. But as of today, the abductor has never been identified. Investigators did explore the possibility that the abduction could be connected to Zach's disappearance, but in the end, they did not believe the two cases were connected because of how different the circumstances were. However, they were never able to rule out the possibility because the abductor, like I said, has never been caught. As the years passed, Zach's case faded from the spotlight. To bring attention, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, also known as NCMEC, created multiple age progression images of Zach, releasing images every 2 years until he reached adulthood. But they never led to Zach. By September of 2025, 25 years had passed since he disappeared. And at that time, investigators provided an update saying they still receive tips and continue to thoroughly investigate each one of them. They now have more than 350 pieces of evidence and 35 binders related to this case, which they continue to revisit with new technology. For example, those binders were recently digitized into a single searchable database through Project Atom, which was named after Adam Walsh. And this is amazing, right? You have 35 binders. So think about how many pages you have within those binders and how many words you have within those pages. So now, if you have an investigator who gets a tip and you want to search a word, a name, a vehicle, an address, if it's ever been entered anywhere in any of those reports, one search, it's going to pop up. It's amazing. This shouldn't even be a project. It should be the standard. Every unsolved case should have to be digitized in this fashion, although I'm sure it's very expensive. But I guarantee you, if they did do that, more cold cases would be solved because half the battle is going through all these reports, organizing them in a way that you can understand them, and then being able to kind of siphon through them to find what you're looking for. It's not easy. It takes a lot of man hours, and it also creates the human error possibility where even though you're searching, you could miss what you're looking for. Project Atom removes that possibility. Investigators also noted that over the past 25 years, they have not publicly ruled out anyone as a suspect or person of interest. They did, however, make one thing very clear. They said, quote, "In 25 years, Zach's mother has not reached out to us and asked what's going on. What's active in the case? What's the status of the case? Recently, we traveled to another part of the state of Florida to talk with her, and we were met with negative results, uncooperative. If that was your son that was 8 years old missing, would you be calling every day, every month, every hour? You wouldn't want to know what's going on? We got nothing." Leah's family also spoke with that same outlet, sharing that they have never stopped looking for Zach, and they have never given up the hope that one day they'll bring him home. And I did watch all of these interviews from the investigator and from Leah's sister-in-law, I believe, her last name's Jimenez, and they asked her point blank, like, why hasn't Leah spoken to them in the last 25 years? And basically she kept saying she has nothing else to add. She's told them everything she knows. And they didn't really elaborate on the neighbor's testimony as far as what they saw. I can only imagine that investigators did ask her about that and she just probably denied it. And maybe she is telling the truth. Maybe she has nothing to add. And yeah, optically, it doesn't look great. But I also think that there is a world here where Leah's struggling to deal with what's going on. And maybe she knows at this point that her decisions during that time led to an opportunity where something like this could happen and she just can't relive it anymore. She has nothing to provide. And she's sitting in the background, knowing that people think she had something to do with it or that she's responsible for what happened. And she's got to live with that either way. So she's not going to sit here and keep going over the same thing all the time with investigators. Me personally, if you're asking me, and if you're here, you probably would. I don't love it, not only because of what she's told doesn't make a ton of sense, but to just kind of disappear after 25 years when there's allegations that you weren't really attentive when the children were around, it's not a great look. Come in, bug me, ask me questions. We talk all the time about how all these other family members are constantly bothering the investigators working their case. And their biggest issue is that the detectives won't even talk to them or call them back. This is the opposite, where you have detectives saying, listen, we haven't heard from this woman. And even when we went to go find her, she had nothing to say. So I really want to hear your guys' opinions on this one. It could go either way. I think it'll be mixed, but let me know what you guys think. Unfortunately, that is the last major update we have in Zach's case. Today, nearly 26 years later, Zach is still missing and his Amber Alert is still active, making it the longest running alert in Florida history. Investigators continue searching for answers, but the one big question remains: what happened to Zach Bernhardt? All right, let's dive in this perspective and talk about some of the potential theories and what can be done moving forward. So the first thing I want to talk about is the accident scenario, right? Could Leah have left the apartment and during that time, Zach walks out and while walking through the complex, he falls, gets hurt, and expires from his injuries. Nobody found him. Highly unlikely. Again, we can throw up the image here of the apartment complex. There's people everywhere. There were hundreds of people searching for him. He could not have gone far. If he was out there, they would have found him. This isn't the middle of the woods. The second scenario to talk about is the possibility that he ran away. And I don't think that's likely as well. Yes, we can acknowledge that Leah didn't display the best parental skills. But at the same time, from what we know, she wasn't abusing Zach, and he loved his mother. And as a child, from what he knew, he probably enjoyed his life, right? He's getting to swim in the pool, build sandcastles, do his crafts, put things together, take them apart. Life was good to him, even though from the outside looking in, we may have believed that he deserved more. And so in the middle of the night, I don't think he's going to decide that he's just going to up and leave and run away, because how is he supposed to know that Leah's going to leave the apartment and he's going to have the opportunity to do so? Some people may say, well, maybe he was attempting to run away, but he was abducted. And I hear you, but I don't think that if he walked outside that apartment, it was with the intention on running away from Leah. And so with those two scenarios out of the way, because although I can't completely rule them out, I believe they're highly unlikely, I want to turn my attention to things that in my opinion are much more plausible. And it's not only the people we should be looking for, but the scenarios we should be exploring. And I want to start with Kevin Jalbert, because whether it's Kevin or someone like Kevin, this is a high probability, right? Because unfortunately, Kevin Jalbert is not the only person out there like him, right? And when I mentioned earlier how big this complex was, the scary thing is there could have been someone living right in that area who was even worse than Kevin, for all we know. And that's really where I would start, because everyone in that building needs to be vetted. There needs to be a manifest that's created documenting as many people as you can who are not only residing at that residence at that time, but any family members or friends that they had staying with them during that time. And then from that point, you have to go through the daunting task of running criminal checks, backgrounds on every single one of them. Not only during the time of this incident, but since then, had they committed any crimes involving children? This is something you'd want to go look for. And if so, where were they on the night in question? Now, again, that's going to take a while, but with the Adam Project and digitizing everything that we already have, that manifest may have already been created. And so you just got to go through it and one by one, look them up and see what they've done since. I'm hoping that their criminal backgrounds were checked at the time, but if it wasn't, that's memorialized. You can go back and check it now and see what these people were not only up to before Zach's disappearance, but after. And when we look at the Kevin Jalbert situation, you have to think about the possibility that if it wasn't a resident or it wasn't a friend of a resident, you also have people who could just be traveling through there looking for someone, looking for a victim of opportunity, just like Kevin Jalbert was. So that's another scenario that I think is highly probable. The problem there is if they don't have any direct ties to the apartment complex, it makes it that much more difficult to identify them. Having said all that, here's my opinion on what happened that night. And let's just acknowledge that it's purely speculative, but based on the minimal information that we do have. I personally believe that Leah was gone much longer that night. I don't know where she went, but based on her previous history, she might have left the parking lot, took her car, and went to visit a friend. I don't know what she was into. I'm not going to even speculate on that, but it's my opinion that multiple people saw her get in her car and leave around that time, and I believe that's what happened. And during that window, one of two things went down. Someone saw her leave, who was at that apartment complex, and then entered the apartment and abducted Zach. Or, and this is the way that I'm leaning, Zach wakes up and he realizes that his mother's no longer there. And like a child would do, he panics, right? His mom has left him before, but usually with other adults. So now he's inside this apartment. Maybe he had a bad dream. He wakes up. He calls out for Leah. She's nowhere to be found. And he's thinking, oh, maybe she's outside. Maybe she's at the pool. Maybe she's just hanging out with a friend and I can yell outside and look and see her or yell for her. And so maybe he changes and he goes outside and he walks through the apartment complex. And unfortunately, someone like a Kevin Jalbert sees him or hears him and they quickly grab him. And it does make me feel like even though this apartment complex is kind of on a main road and it could have been just a transient passing by, we might be looking at another resident who had maybe seen Zach alone on many occasions and was just looking for that opportunity. And if that's the case, they could get him inside, get him quiet, and then move him to a different location. And obviously, if that's what happened here, we're not looking at a good outcome. And it's ironic that we're talking about the Adam Project and we're talking about Adam Walsh, because for most of you, you know that case, but for anybody who doesn't, it was only a matter of seconds where Adam went to a different aisle in a store and the wrong guy just happened to be there. And he was able to take advantage of the situation. He took Adam and he killed him. And I hope that's not what happened here, but we try to be logical and reasonable on this channel. And based on the fact that we're looking at 25 years with no sign of Zach anywhere, the outcome looks bleak. But it doesn't mean we stop fighting. And we got to keep moving forward, because regardless of what happened, we need those answers, not only for Leah, but for all of her family, for that community. And I really think that's where, so far, investigators have done a good job. Digitizing this entire case, it's important. It seems like even after all these years, they're still motivated to solve it. You got a lot of moms, a lot of dads working that department and probably see their own kids in Zach. I know with Michelle Norris, with my department, that's something that I always look at now. Every time I see Michelle's face as a 7-year-old, I think about Peyton and Tenley and if it were my daughter and what I would do to find her. And unfortunately with Michelle, as some of you know, they did find her. It wasn't the outcome that we were hoping for. So we digitize the reports. We look at the manifest. We go through everybody again. Maybe we bring everyone in for an interview. We use the latest science and technology to our advantage wherever we can. If there's grants or financial resources that you need, you reach out to the people that can provide them, me being one of them. And we do whatever we can to get those answers, even if we have to think outside the box. But overall, it's going to take someone coming forward. If all of those opportunities, all of those angles you go with, they don't work out, someone knows something. And law enforcement has said this multiple times. He didn't just disappear, right? He went somewhere. Somebody took him somewhere. And we just got to find the right person. Maybe not the person who did it, but somebody connected to that person. Someone who finally, after all these years, has enough guilt to finally come forward and say what happened. And the only concern I have here with that, and this is one more scenario that I want to mention, because if I don't, you guys will beat me up over it, as you should. We talk about Leah, and we talk about how law enforcement believes that she's not telling the full story. And I have said that I believe maybe she just disappeared for a couple hours and she knows how bad that looks, so she has been unwilling to admit to that. But what if it's worse? What if something happened inside that apartment? What if something happened where Leah got frustrated and she accidentally or intentionally hurt Zach? And what if the car leaving that apartment complex with multiple neighbors reporting seeing that was actually Leah taking Zach and removing him from that location. Is that possible? If I sit here and say it's not, would you guys respect or trust me anymore? Of course you wouldn't, as you shouldn't. Yeah, it's possible. It's the same reason that nobody has been ruled out as a person of interest or suspect in this case. Is it also possible that Leah, being frustrated, not being able to handle the financial responsibilities associated with having a child or feeling burdened by having Zach around, made a decision to give him up to somebody else who she felt could better take care of him? Or, and I really hope this isn't the case, but maybe she was given money for him, right? We hear about these illegal adoptions all the time where someone comes forward and says, hey, we're looking to have a child. We're willing to pay you X amount of dollars. I think that scenario is far less likely because from what I've learned, there isn't anything that appears to align with Leah coming into a large sum of money. So if anything, and I know some of you are thinking it, are we looking at a scenario where something happened inside that apartment and Leah just, there's no way she can tell us the truth. She and she alone knows what happened. And I've said it before, if only one person knows what happened, then yeah, it could die with them. And that would be an absolute tragedy in this case, because many people are still wondering and still hoping that Zach's out there somewhere, including his own family. But whether that's the case or not, I truly hope that there's someone out there somewhere who knows exactly what happened that night and they finally do the right thing and come forward. So just to recap, 8-year-old Zachary Bernhardt was last seen on the evening of September 10th, 2000 at the Savannah Trace apartment complex in Clearwater, Florida. At approximately 4:47 a.m. on September 11th, Zach's mother reported him missing after telling investigators she had left him asleep in her apartment while she went for a walk. Investigators found no sign of forced entry or struggle, and despite extensive searches and decades of investigation, Zach has never been found. If anyone has information, please contact NCMEC at 1-800-843-5678 or the Clearwater Police Department at 1-727-562-4420. As always, my final words go out to the friends and family of Zach, including you, Leah, if you happen to be listening or watching this. I know you're getting a bad rap for this one. And to be candid, I want to find out what happened to your son. But in order to do that, we have to be honest with each other. And I think at this point, I hope you have realized that there was a series of poor decisions that were made that left yourself and your son in a compromising position. And someone took advantage of that. Now, if you are responsible, you need to come forward and do the right thing as well. You owe that to your son and to the rest of your family. But if you're not, keep fighting. Keep fighting for your son, and we're going to keep fighting for him as well. And if there's ever a world where you want to come speak with me and you want to get your side of the story out there, I'm available. I would love nothing more than to sit down with you and have a conversation. I can come to you or I can fly you out here. We all want the same thing, and that's to figure out what happened to Zach. And I hope sooner than later we have those answers. Until then, please, everyone stay safe out there. Keep your children close, and I'll see you soon.